All right, so let's move on to item nine, which is our review of real estate performance and pacing recommendation. There we are. There's Mr. Whalen has joined us. So we have John. There he is. All right, who would like to kick this off?
Tim, you want to kick it off or you want me to jump right in?
I think you're on, Scott.
I think you can jump right in, Scott.
And you're on. Looks like you're muted, Tim. Sorry.
I have two mute buttons on my system, and they get me in trouble.
You got one.
Just really quickly, the Verus review on real estate kind of came out of the fact that we changed the benchmarking process on a quarter-to-quarter basis. When they did that and benchmarked the private real estate program to its own performance, we agreed that Verus would annually come in and do a deeper dive review of real estate performance, and that's why we're here today. With that, I'll turn it over to Mr. Whalen.
Thanks, Tim. So this is our, as Tim mentioned, this is our first go at this out of the gate, and I'm joined by my colleague, John Wozniak. John is the head of our real estate research team. He's been with Verus for 23 years. He's a shareholder. He leads our real estate research efforts globally, and he also leads the production of our annual real estate market outlook piece, which he'll be sharing today as we get towards the end of the presentation in advance of our recommendation. So thanks for joining, John. With that, I will share my screen. And so what I'm going to talk about today is focus on three primary areas: where the real estate program has been and where it is today in terms of positioning and performance, and then talk about pacing and what it looks like going forward and how to achieve and maintain the strategic allocation to real estate. And then John is going to take over and talk a little bit about the market, which will, you know, sort of dovetail with Tim's comments in the growth portfolio review and respond to any questions. And then we'll finish up with a recommendation. Any questions before I get started?
I don't see any, Scott, so continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So with that, I'll take you to our executive summary slide on page three and really talk about, you know, the observations that we saw. So the real estate allocation is below current and long-term policy targets, interestingly, but there's good reason for that. And that's because two reasons primarily. That's because the market, the equity market, has really taken off, providing sort of a denominator effect, right? As the real estate program grows slowly and the rest of the portfolio grows quickly, the share of real estate in the total portfolio has declined a little bit. And then also due to the modest commitment pace, because of the uncertainty around the pandemic, right? So there was good contribution pacing up through 2019, and then it stopped in 2020 just because of the really complete uncertainty in the market, which continues to some extent to this day. And those were really the two reasons why it hasn't kept up with the short-term target allocation. With respect to performance, it's performed, you know, reasonably well and certainly in line with expectations. And we'll go over that in a little bit more detail. The pacing study, preliminary pacing study that we performed, shows that you guys can afford to commit another 100 to 200 million and even more to the program on an annual basis to get you up to that long-term strategic allocation target. And then, as John will point out a little bit later, current market conditions favor light industrial, multifamily housing, and non-traditional sectors we find more favorable and think, you know, there are things like public storage, student housing, senior housing facilities, medical facilities, et cetera. So going to slide five and talking, continuing with an overview and talking about where you are. So we talked about the actual allocation relative to target. You can see right there the current mix as of 6/30 puts you at 5.6%. And this is relative to your near-term target as approved by the board resolution last year of 8% and long-term policy of 10%. Interestingly, and we'll show in a bit, the actual allocation has been up above 10% in previous periods. And as the, you know, the total fund value bounces around. So that 5.6% is not at your target, but you know, it real well could, soon could be, depending on whether or not we see some sort of sizable equity market drawdown. But nevertheless, you want to continue your sort of steady growth through steady commitments over time. Another review page here, program review page here. You can see that 5.6% on the left relative to the rest of your plan. And then the two charts on the right take a little bit of explaining and getting used to. So the one up top, the orange line is the percent of total fund, right? Real estate program as a percent of total fund. So the end of that line is equals to the 5.6% where you are currently. As you can see, it has been up above 10 and even around 11% previously. It's come down it's gotten more in line with target. And then you can see here, it fell pretty precipitously as total fund assets rose precipitously, right? So that's that denominator effect that I talked about there. Before the market really took off on a tear, you can see that it was up around near your near-term target. And then the blue area chart underneath that is as a percent of commitment, right? So the as a percent of commitment, it's the left-hand scale, and it's roughly around 50%. So it's running at 50% is the value of the program relative to the amount that you've committed in the current funds that you have active. So it implies, you know, sort of a mature fund that needs to be refreshed. And then the chart below here, it's your, it takes this commitment bar and it area and it just shows it in dollars. So you got your NAV at about 600 million, your commitment, PRE being private real estate commitment at about 1.2, getting you to that 50% or so up here. This is really a chart for reference. It comes out of our investment performance report, bit of an eye chart, but I wanted to put it in there in case you wanted to go through the detail of each of the funds in your portfolio at your leisure. And then moving into positioning, talks about program diversification and basically just kind of eyeballing this chart at a high level. You can see that you're well diversified. Tim was talking about the different investment sectors earlier. And here we have by property type. You can see office, which makes up most of the institutional investor universe by volume. You can see office is the largest portion. You've got industrial, which Tim was talking about, multifamily, really apartment buildings, and then retail, a smaller portion here, and hotel as well. Raw land through your opportunistic investments, and we got additional residential, mixed use, and others. So broadly diversified across property type, similar story in geography. Domestic being the bulk, U.S. being the bulk of your investments, some outside the U.S., smaller portion outside the U.S. Here you've got by manager. You guys have a lineup of managers that you have long-term relationships with, for the most part, investing in multiple funds as funds open, are invested, and close, and picking up the next fund in the series. DLJ being the largest, and then you've got a couple of smaller one-offs. One is Paulson, and then you've got some other series that sort of round out the program in with low double-digit investments. So again, across managers, good diversification in the program there. And lastly, and importantly, vintage year diversification, right? So this gets to the idea of you don't want to put all your eggs in one time period basket. And so you commit and make investments across time periods. So you're the total real estate portfolio is not invested in real estate prior to the global financial crisis, for example. So you want to be pretty well diversified across vintage year. You are well diversified across vintage years, notwithstanding the slowdown in the program in 20 and 21. And you're actually even better diversified than this chart implies. So it looks like you've got a pretty big bulge here in 2015, both from commitment and from market value. From a commitment perspective, these are by vintage year, right? And so you actually made some investments in 2016 and 2017 in the 2015 vintage year funds. And so as we ramp up the program and continue to make commitments, we would expect this vintage year diversification to continue. So on to performance. So there's some explanation here that I want to start with to make sure that you understand some of these metrics and what we're looking at here. You know, we, as Tim mentioned in the beginning, we changed how we look at real estate in your quarterly investment reports, which makes perfect sense from private markets perspective. We talked about it, you guys agreed, and I'll just refresh your memory again for the sake of the overview. And that is that, you know, these private markets investments, there's nothing you can do on a quarter by quarter basis, right? It's not like a public markets investment manager where if you lose your confidence in them, you can change out a manager really at any time that you want. When you commit to a fund, you're in a fund for 6, 8, 10, 12 years, and you're contractually obligated to remain. And so it really makes sense to look at these things on an annual basis to say, hey, are things going the way we expect them to be? Are we okay? Do we need to make any sort of adjustments, course corrections? And so that's what we're trying to look at here. And we're going to do that in a couple of ways. So instead of looking at a time-weighted return, like you do in your public markets, we look at a dollar-weighted return. And that's because these managers have control over when the dollars are put to work. So it, you take the, you know, the first investment that you make, and then you get some cash back, and then you make, you know, give them more money when they make a capital call, and then you get some cash back. And so you actually want to know how the return looks on that dollar weighted basis. And that's what the IRR internal rate of return is. It's what's the rate of return that equate all of those cash flows, both inflows and outflows, from the beginning of time to the end of time. And that's the return that you're looking at here. Well, that's not how benchmark returns are calculated, right? And in the public market. So we take this benchmark, this FTSE NAREIT, it's a REIT benchmark that you could invest in if you wanted to just invest in public market vehicles. But we gotta adjust that to make it an IRR, right? So we gotta say, okay, well, what would have happened if I'd invested in that benchmark at the same time that I put money into the Invesco Real Estate 3 fund, for example, and then got money back out at the same time that I got a distribution from this fund. And so in that way, you can compare what your private markets fund did to what a public market equivalent PME would have done. And so that makes it a good apples to apples comparison to say, hey, you know, are we doing good here with our private markets investment? Or could we have just done as well or even better than if we had just put it into the NAREIT? Kind of like you do with your active equity managers saying, did they do better than the S&P 500, for example? So one more caveat here, and that is that with private equity, not private real estate, but private equity, it's an easier comparison because you can do the cash flows exactly on the day that they came in and out of the fund, right? So you can apply them to the day that they would have gone in and out of the S&P 500, for example. Here, we get this data from Cambridge, and Cambridge does it by vintage year. So it's a rougher heuristic than we can do, say, with private equity or private credit, but it's still sort of directionally correct and just another indicator, okay? And then TVPI, to extend the explanation, is total value to paid in capital. So what's my investment worth relative to what I've paid into it? And that's in terms of distributions that I've gotten back, right? And also in terms of what's remaining and how is that valued. So the total value of the investment relative to what I paid in. And so you've got that compared to a peer group, right? So we kind of are doing this similarly to what we do with your public markets investments to the best degree that we can. And again, pretty good heuristics. And so what it shows, if you just look down these columns, is you've got some that are outperforming pretty handily, some that are relatively flat relative to the PME, and some that are underperforming, but not by a ton. And by the way, we're talking about your value add managers now. We're going to get to your opportunistic managers momentarily. And then if you look compared to peers, it's sort of a similar story, right? You've got some that are sort of right around the median peer, some that have outperformed, and some that have underperformed by a bit. So this is where I say that you know, your program is doing pretty well and in line with expectations from both a public market equivalent comparison and a median peer comparison. So no real concerns broadly from a program level. And then we go to opportunistic. I'll skip the long-winded explanation that I did on the previous page because it's the same. And we compared your opportunistic funds to a public market benchmark and to the median peer. And it's largely just the same output. So if you scan these, pay these individual metrics, you'll see that they compare relatively well to the public market equivalent and the median peer. Some are over, some are sort of flat, and some are slightly under. We've got DLJ here that is underperformed pretty significantly with a couple of the older funds. And then you can see the 2013 vintage year outperformed, and then 2018, you know, the easy argument there is that it's still new and too soon to tell, right? Very early chapters, but a little bit of disappointment with the DLJ funds. And I know your staff is reviewing that and developing a plan with what to do with respect to that, whether or not to continue into the next fund in the series. Couple of next charts are to show you how your funds have been invested, right? The pacing of the investment and whether it's within expectations. And it is. So this sort of brown dotted line here, maroon dotted line here represents our non-core average pacing from when the fund was incepted through its first, second, third, fourth, and so on years of the life of the fund, right? So it common sizes the pacing back to year zero for each of the funds, regardless of the vintage year, and goes through the life of the fund. And you can see here that you know, you're pretty close around our view of what the average is, with most of the funds being getting close to fully invested between years three and four. You've got this one fund down here that is the Long Wharf Fund 6, 2019 vintage year, right? So you can think about why their pacing might have slowed down a little bit. Their vintage year was 2019. They went into 2020 and we're seeing the same market that your staff was looking at, and just sort of slowed down the transaction slowed down. And so the pace of investing slowed down as well. And then similar story with your opportunistic funds, sort of similar between years 3 and 4, getting close to fully invested, maybe upwards into year 5. So no concerns with respect to the pacing. The message here also is that, you know, these funds are getting invested, which this line shows investment pacing relative to the total commitment, you're also getting distributions back on all these, which again highlights the need to kind of keep the program moving on a year-over-year basis. And then lastly, before I turn it over to John to talk about the market outlook, this is our forecast of the future pacing and commitments and how that impacts the allocation relative to target. And so we go through each of these funds. We have net cash flow projections, which is made up of contributions and distributions, and then what that does to the NAV. And so you can see how these roll forward. We get most of these from the managers themselves and plug them into our pacing model. And so without any action, right, if you were just to say, we're not going to contribute any more to the real estate program or make any additional commitments, you can see how the allocation dwindles over time down to zero, as you would expect, as that your current funds and managers liquidate towards the end of the fund life. So this is for value add. And this is for opportunistic. And so really, if you don't do anything going out 4 or 5 years, your program will completely roll off, once again, highlighting the need to make additional commitments to achieve that target allocation. And so with that, before I get to what you can probably infer are our recommendations, I'm going to turn it over to John to talk about where we're seeing opportunity and where we're less favorable. John, take it away.
Thanks, Scott. You can go ahead and flip to the next slide here. So we've got some slides here that I've taken from our Real Assets Outlook, which is published once a year. Within this outlook, we take an intermediate term view, looking out 3 to 5 years. The recommendations are not meant to be short-term tactical. It's hard to do that in an illiquid asset class like real estate, but really meant to help guide strategic tilts within portfolios. So this outlook was published a few months back, but the views largely hold. The first slide here shows our overall outlook for the different styles within real estate. You can see core, value added, opportunistic, and real estate debt. A lot of text here. I'm not going to read through it all, but you can see on the right what our general outlooks are. And you can, on core real estate, we did move to a negative view at the beginning of the pandemic, but it really is a nuanced view. There's just a lot of uncertainty with regards to how real estate would respond due to the unprecedented government lockdowns, recession, changes in use of real estate from work from home, as well as e-commerce and shopping from home. And so, you know, we did move to a negative view. Within core, you're typically holding existing portfolios, existing assets. And so what we saw after the GFC was that existing assets, they do take a while to change, adjust their values. There's fewer transactions. The appraisal process is slow. The appraisal process relies on comps and comparable transactions. And during the pandemic, the early parts, there was just not a lot of transactions. Transaction volumes fell off, and it has been difficult to get price discovery on a lot of assets. Looking back to the GFC, it took, you know, 6, 7, 8 quarters for some of that to flush through the market, as again, that appraisal process tends to be fairly slow. So when we saw this happening, we were concerned. We took a negative view on the space. And really our concerns within, when you dig down into those assets, our concerns are really fall within the office and retail property type specifically. Hospitality as well, but that's a smaller portion of the private market, typically when you're looking at core real estate. And I've got some slides that will get into some of the concerns on those two property types specifically and the headwinds that they will continue to face when we get there. But really one of the key recommendations here was to diversify away from some of the traditional core sectors that you get within your private markets, namely office and retail, into, as Scott alluded to in his introduction, moving into more alternative property types, gaining exposure to things like self-storage, senior housing, student housing, medical office, single family homes for rent, life science, those types of assets. And I've got a slide that will show how those assets have grown as a portion of the universe. But we do have positive views on the non-core sectors, value-added and opportunistic, which match up with your portfolio nicely. We like the ability to deploy fresh capital into this market, where there may be attractive entry points and to take advantage of situational distress. We do think that there will be some distress in office, retail, and hospitality. Up to this point, there really hasn't been a broad wave of that. It hasn't been like what we saw after the GFC yet. Many of those owners and lenders kind of came into this in a stronger position financially. So there hasn't been a huge wave of forced selling to this point. There will be some as it plays out, but it's not as broad based as we may have thought it could have been at the beginning of the pandemic. And debt finally is a neutral view. There's been pressure on returns as rates have dropped, and there's been increased competition from private non-traditional lenders. Scott, will you flip the next slide, please? So here we're showing some recent performance and some historical performance. The slide on the bottom left just shows annual real estate returns. The light blue bar is the total return. And returns had been moderating prior to the pandemic over the last 5 years prior, instead of getting the 10 to 15% returns that we saw during 2010 to 2015, returns had moderated down to what was more typical of real estate, 6-8%. But during the pandemic in 2020, returns just had a modest gain of around 2%. Now, this chart came from what we published a few months ago. It doesn't have 2021 yet, but returns have been moving up over the last couple quarters. We've seen 1.7, you can see on the bottom left, we break out quarterly. The second quarter of 2020 was really the only negative total return quarter that we saw. It was a modest write down of 1% broadly. And then it has turned positive to recover some of that. And the last quarter, the core real estate returns were a robust 3.7%. So we've seen a bit of a recovery there. The chart in the middle shows the non-core space, and this is showing vintage year median returns for both value-added and opportunistic. And what we've highlighted with the circles on this page is some of the best vintages have come out of periods of stress and recession. We saw that in the early 2000s with the tech crash, and we saw it after the GFC as well. And you know, sometimes it has taken a few years for, you know, to deploying into the early part of the recovery. But this, you know, we think that now is a good time to be deploying into the market, given there has been some stress and managers are able to capitalize on that. And this chart also illustrates, like Scott mentioned, the need for vintage year diversification, because you don't want to be deploying excess return or excess capital into a single vintage when that could be a determinant of the returns for the program. Finally, the chart on the right just shows historical sector performance. Obviously, industrial had been driving a lot of the returns prior to the pandemic, and retail had been struggling. And a lot of those trends that were occurring prior to the pandemic are still occurring post-pandemic. There's been a huge demand and surge for e-commerce and warehouse, whereas retail has continued to struggle, and we're likely still oversupplied there. You can flip to the next slide, Scott. So in terms of some of the fundamentals, the bottom left is showing vacancies. We did see vacancies start to increase at the beginning of the pandemic across multifamily, office, and retail. Industrial, on the other hand, is still chugging away at near all-time lows of vacancy, and that has continued. Over what's not shown here is over the last couple of quarters, multifamily has come back, vacancy has dropped back to near all-time lows, and retail has leveled off. Office, on the other hand, the vacancy rates have continued to tick upward, and that is still an area of concern for us. The office leases tend to be longer duration of 5 to 7 years, sometimes 10-year leases. And while a lot of buildings are empty right now, those tenants are still paying those bills. However, over the next 5 to 7 years, we may see some employers, you know, change their office space usage. And there's just, again, a lot of uncertainty as to how that plays out right now. And there's a slide that digs into office in a couple slides. The middle chart is showing cap rate spreads. And this is, cap rates are the income that you're receiving relative to the value of the properties. And we look at the spreads over treasuries to look at the overall health of real estate and whether it's attracting capital from other sources as either a fixed income replacement or the need to gain income where you can't get it in the some of the fixed income credit markets. And what we've seen is there's still healthy spreads with treasury rates falling off this year. And cap rates have been kind of slowly progressing downward. It's hovering around 4% right now, broadly speaking, for the market. Those cap rates still remain healthy. As you can see, when you look back at the prior stress periods in early 2000s and during the global financial crisis, those spreads basically evaporated, and there was no premium for holding real estate assets. And so that would be something that we're watching as a potential concern. But for now, it looks healthy.
John, let me jump in and suggest that it might, just in the interest of time, it might be useful to get into maybe blend some of the backdrop into the recommendations. I don't know how you guys feel about that, but it might be useful. We've had a fair amount of discussion, as you probably know from today and prior meetings, on, you know, the state of the market. So it might be good to go to look at the recommendations and backfill with explanation where required. That's my thought.
Thanks for that, Scott. And we will jump right to the recommendation slide, which, as you probably inferred from the comments so far, are pretty straightforward and in line with the comments that we've made. So first of all, with respect to recommendations, it's important to keep in mind that the adjustments to the program should be flexible on a year-over-year basis, right? Depending on what happens to real estate values, what happens to capital markets, what happens to the property types and our outlooks on those, and what happens to the total fund, you want to adjust on a year-over-year basis, which is why we will want to do this annually. And then based on current conditions and positioning, we think that you should start ramping up your commitments again. I think your investment staff has something that they've got in the hopper that's pretty close to being fully due diligenced that they're looking to make a commitment to. But we're talking about anywhere from $100 to $200 million a year, roughly, and even higher than that, potentially if opportunities present themselves, to get up to that 10% long-term strategic target. And that means maybe a couple of three, maybe four funds per year. So that's the recommendation roughly around the commitment pacing, at least in the near term. And then with respect to the type of areas to be looking at, broadly diversified funds as your core holding, similar to what you've got in your program today, but with an emphasis on industrial, multifamily, and non-traditional within those broadly diversified funds, to the extent that you can find them, funds that are raising capital today with those tilts. And then also sort of extending your purview or your search out to the specialty funds that John mentioned, you know, that you would likely be emphasizing in your core holdings, but maybe some satellite funds around those that are those specialty funds when the opportunities present themselves for firms that are raising in the areas that of high interest that we've identified.
All right. Jerry, you had your hand up.
Yeah, Scott, a couple of questions. I noticed on this presentation for recommendations, business is not in there, which is perhaps understandable. I wish you'd take a minute and also explain, just to give an example of non-traditional sectors. And then if you would comment on an interesting trend I think I'm seeing, whether or not it's part of the woke trend, I have no idea. But there are some communities that are now talking about it or have in fact implemented policies where they're no longer going to approve single family dwellings for zone. They're rezoning all the property. So you'll never be able to build another single family house. Could you comment on that too?
So interestingly, personal experience on your last question, my area has not prohibited single family zoning, but they are strongly encouraging new development to be multifamily. So we're experiencing that here in what is presumably a pretty high rent district. John, I'll ask you to comment on that if you have any insights, but also on explaining what those other non-traditional sectors are.
Yeah, so I'll start with the non-traditional sectors. Typically, those are including things like self-storage units, public storage, senior and student housing, medical office centers, life science centers, research buildings, data centers, single family housing is for rent is a part of that, as well as, you know, cell towers or you see that within the REIT market as well, where you don't see it as much in the public or private market. Single family home for rent is a strategy that really kind of started post GFC when there was a lot of foreclosed homes sitting around and institutions, you know, large investors started gobbling those up and managing those as, rental units. And it took a while to get economies of scale for a lot of those investors. And there was some growing pains for many of those. It has become more of an institutional strategy as technology has, you know, been developed to allow the management of those types of assets. And I think some of the legislation you're talking about or regulations will probably enhance the value of those going forward, because there'd be just less supply. And a lot of these rental strategies, they're more suburban assets. And I think some of the regulations that you're seeing are more in some of those more closer in urban areas. Does that help address the question?
Yeah, it just occurred to me that we may be missing a bet here. We could combine self-storage with student housing, senior residential, and any of a number of other individuals. We could take care of with a self-storage investment. I'm only half kidding. If self-storage is going to go the way it is, there may be strange opportunities in there for us. But
Jerry, you should start a fund, Jerry.
Yeah, right.
There you go. Seems reasonable. Mm-hmm. Other questions or comments for Scott and or John? Not seeing any right now. Well, that's helpful. Thank you, gentlemen.
Yeah.
For the recommendations and the thoughts and unprecedented times, to be sure. At least it seems that way to me.
Thanks very much.
Great. Thanks, guys. No, there's no action to be taken on this item, so there are no votes required.